Tune Infinity. Before this, Hellmate, Barto, and Rose Moncato with the tune Ecstasy. That's about it for me for today. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you missed a show or you want to get in touch with me, feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the dangerous executive orders issued by Donald Trump, which are likely to erode a range of civil liberties and human rights.
We're joined for the full hour with Law and Disorder co-host Stephen Rohde, who will explain what Trump's dismantling of DEI means to communities that have long been discriminated against, and how Trump's separate executive order would curtail academic freedom by conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Stay with us.
I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
This is Black History Month, and we at Law and Disorder are eager to celebrate it. That, sadly, is not what's happening in the Trump administration. The Defense Department, under the headline Identity Months Dead at DOD, has eliminated various heritage months already, including Black History Month. Even more alarming, however, is Trump's executive order eliminating the use of DEI, which stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, as factors to be considered by all federal agencies when hiring their employees. Now, Trump claims the elimination of DEI will result in America becoming a colorblind and merit-based society. However, DEI programs do not hire less qualified applicants for jobs. They simply require governmental agencies to seek out well-qualified minority and women and those who are disabled for all job openings. That is, they simply require that they remove any discriminatory barriers that stand in the way of a would-be employee and that result, therefore, in hiring fewer well-qualified women and minorities and disabled in their workforce. Marguerite Huang, the Southern Poverty Law Center's president and chief executive officer, got it right when she said, and I quote, his, meaning Trump's, attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion are just a sanitized substitute for the racist comments that can no longer be spoken openly, close quote. Meanwhile, and closely related to Trump's attack on DEI, are his multifaceted attack on immigrants, and in particular, as we're going to discuss today, on those who join in public protests against his policies, such as his policies on Israel and Palestine. For many years, and especially after October 7th, as a way to stifle demands for Palestinian human rights and sovereignty, there's been a concerted effort to conflate criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism. Now Trump is up the ante. On January 29th, he pledged to deport non-citizen college students and others who take part in pro-Palestinian protests, and promising to again immediately take action from his Justice Department to make sure they are prosecuted. He issued a warning to all of the resident immigrants who join in what he called the quote-unquote pro-jihadist protests, warning them that, and I quote again, we will find you and we will deport you, close quote. Never mind that these are exercises of the First Amendment that all on our shores are entitled to be governed by. He threatened to cancel the foreign student visas of what he called, quote, Hamas sympathizers on college campuses, which have been infested with radicalism like never before, close quote. Well, to implement these sweeping threats, Trump issued an executive order. My goodness, hasn't he entered many of those, entitled Additional Measures to Combat Anti-Semitism. Among other things, the order reaffirms Executive Order 13899 that Trump signed back on December 11th of 2019 during his first term. It required all executive departments and agencies charged with enforcing anti-discrimination laws to consider the highly controversial working definition of anti-Semitism adopted in 2016 by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA, including 11 quote-unquote examples of anti-Semitism. And we're going to ask our guest about those definitions of anti-Semitism on the show in a few minutes. On May 1st of 2024, the House of Representatives, on a 320-91, nevertheless bipartisan vote, passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. It would enshrine the very same flawed IHRA working definition in federal law, and it now goes before the Senate. On January 21st, without even waiting for the act to become law, Harvard University set a dangerous precedent by agreeing to adopt the IHRA definition as part of a settlement of two federal lawsuits that had accused the school of failing to do enough to prevent anti-Semitic discrimination. And we'll talk more about that in the show in a few minutes as well. So today we've decided to devote our entire show to these two important topics. Our guest today is Stephen Rohde, a civil rights activist, author, and constitutional scholar. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace in Los Angeles, and he is also a past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, a past chair of the Death Penalty Focus, and of Bend the Arc, which is a Jewish partnership for justice. Despite that long list of affiliations, today Steve Rohde is not speaking on behalf of any of them, just himself. Well, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome as a guest this time to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jim and Marie. I'm really happy to be with you today.
Well, it's nice to have you here as a guest as opposed to just one of our wonderful co-hosts. Well, Steve, Trump's attacks on DEI seem to resonate with his voter base, don't they? In fact, the Trump campaign used its attacks on DEI, in effect, as an all-purpose target for society's ills. And especially, Trump campaigned on the idea that using DEI results in lesser qualified candidates for a job getting the federal job at issue. Is Trump right about the effects of DEI resulting in lesser qualified people being hired?
No, he's not right about that. He's not right about many things. This is a dangerous executive order. It was issued on literally the first day he came into office. It's a frontal attack on DEI, which is a legal constitutional program being used broadly in the workplace. There's all kinds of evidence that DEI programs make for stronger workforces. We don't do a good enough job at saying what is involved in DEI. It involves additional training. It involves recruitment. It involves attracting people to the workplace because, and what Trump and his base want to ignore, is the history of discrimination in America, going back to our founding with the original sin of slavery. We have not yet reached that colorblind society that he speaks of in his executive order. And I remember Chief Justice John Roberts saying we've reached a colorblind society. We have not. The disparities in income, in employment, in housing, in healthcare, and all the rest are obvious. And so DEI is legal and constitutional. What he does is he wants to use his attack on DEI, which follows on the Republican playbook for decades. They truly would prefer, when they say make America great again, it's the again. They want to go back to a time where there was a patriarchy, where there was a dominance of white straight males that controlled everything, and that's where J.D. Vance wants to return to, and it's where Trump wants to return to.
Many leaders in the civil rights movement, among others, believe that attacks against DEI efforts are really just a pretext for racist theories generally, but in a way that sounds more polite than some of the old racist slurs. Do you agree?
Yes, it really builds on what I was saying. You know, we've reached the point, the old days of Faubus and the other racist leaders who could openly speak about the white race and make disparaging comments about blacks and women, frankly, as well as homosexuals and others. You know, they've cleaned up their act. So they find targets. They find words to be a stand-in for the kind of racist and sexist and homophobic rhetoric that they really believe in. You know, this has been part of this attack for years on woke-ism. That's become a dirty word in American conversation. But I did some research on this. Martin Luther King gave a sermon years ago at the height of his work, and he spoke of awakening the country. The country needed to be awake to the kinds of racism that persists in this country and now to this very day. That's what it means to be woke. That's what it means to pursue DEI. It has been, it is lawful, it's constitutional, and he is trying to launch a frontal attack on it through these executive orders.
Steve, therefore, is there any real legal recourse to what Trump has done with regard to, well, eliminating DEI from hiring practices at the federal government agencies? Or is it only Congress that could reverse what he has done? And in fact, does even Congress have the power to do that? Is in essence, what he has done over the federal government agencies on the matter of DEI subject to someone's control other than his own?
Yes, I do believe it is. Lawsuits are being organized and filed to attack these specific executive orders. He is handed us and handed the lawyers and the challengers a gift because he is saying the quiet part out loud. He attached a fact sheet to his executive order. By doing so, he is reversing laws that have been passed by bipartisan majorities for decades, going back to the 1960s when the early voting rights and civil rights laws were passed. I think those will be successfully challenged in court. Now, if we need new legislation in Congress, that may be more problematical. Unfortunately, the Republican Party controls the Senate by a slim majority. They control the House. They, of course, control the White House. And with a 6 majority on the Supreme Court, they control that court. Congress may address these issues. I think that's doubtful. The toadies in the Republican Party are in lockstep with Trump and the MAGA agenda. So I do think we're going to have to confront it in court. When we do that, we will be confronting something called the unitary executive theory. This has been at work in law reviews, in the Federalist Society. Someone you'll remember, John Yoo, who wrote the terrible torture memos allowing for waterboarding. John Yoo wrote an entire book on the unitary executive theory. That right-wing theory says one man, in this case it's a man, stands at the top of the executive branch. He has total control over everything within the executive branch, and he cannot be impaired by Congress or any laws that Congress passes. Some on the Supreme Court have flirted with the unitary executive theory. They may dust it off and use it again when these cases get to the United States Supreme Court. There are good lawyers on our side. There are good lawyers trained in defending our anti-discrimination laws, and they are doing the heavy lifting right now.
Stephen Rohde, Trump has also urged private companies to stop considering DEI as well. But most companies claim that encouraging diversity in the workplace has resulted in improvements to their workforce. Can Trump outlaw, by executive order, the use of DEI by private, non-governmental entities? Could Congress do so?
So we need to distinguish between purely private companies, any run-of-the-mill companies that you or I are familiar with, versus companies that take federal funds, federal contractors, and other institutions that receive federal funds. Now, here is a doctrine that may come back to haunt us, because in the years when we wanted to ensure that private companies were not themselves discriminating, especially federal contractors, universities that receive federal funds, we insisted that they comply with anti-discrimination laws. Trump is now turning that on its head. He's saying if you receive federal funds, now you must withdraw your DEI programs and eliminate them, or else risk losing federal funds. And in the university context, we'll talk about that later. Private companies, fortunately, in the face of what Trump has done in the last few weeks, are stepping up. I'm a card-carrying member of Costco. I'm not a paid representative, but Costco has said that its DEI programs have helped its workforce, that they have a stronger, diverse workforce because of DEI, and they have no intention of giving it up. There are many other corporations. A National Football League has announced that, and other groups. And I applaud those companies. I think we all should patronize companies that are supporting their DEI programs and thank them for doing that. Those private companies are free to choose their policies, and I think they should be complimented for doing so.
Well, Steve, we've moved through this rather quickly. I think you've certainly hit the high points, but I wonder, do you have some final thoughts on this business of DEI, what the elimination of it is at a federal level is likely, what that's likely to have as an impact on, the performance of federal agencies, for example. But any other thoughts you might have with respect to what Trump is doing around diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Yes, I think it's obligatory of all our listeners to go to the White House site. There is Ending Radical and Wasteful Government DEI Programs and Preferencing. He issued that on day one. It really gives you the essence of what they're doing here. They are calling it shameful discrimination to combat discrimination on the basis of race, gender, and ethnicity. They are turning these issues on their heads, and there's a myth in all of this, and this myth came out when we had that terrible plane crash in Washington, D.C., and J.D. Vance seized the microphone, and he suggested that there were incompetent air traffic controllers and others because of DEI. That's a slur. That's a racist and sexist remarks. DEI does not promote incompetence. Everyone who takes a federal job must be fully competent and well-trained, and they are retrained and retested in their jobs. We have that assurance across the board. So the myth that DEI promotes incompetent people is a corrupt myth. It's used to favor what Trump is trying to achieve here. I think everybody should be offended by it, because it is just dressing up racist and sexist and homophobic language, which all of us should condemn.
Oh, yes. And the other thing about it is this. If one wonders whether Trump is right or whether corporate America is right, private companies that use DEI, and more and more and more of them do, have actually studied the situation, studied the effects of doing so, and found that the productivity, the efficiency, the overall performance of their company or corporation does better, in fact, when they have increased with well-qualified and more diverse workforce. And they, of course, are interested in their bottom line. So if you're out there listening and wondering about all of this, On the one hand, Trump is saying this leads to inefficiency. It leads to hiring people who aren't as competent. But anyone who thinks that corporate America wouldn't have studied the situation and wouldn't be able to show, as it does through these studies, that this in fact helps them with their bottom line and with the functioning of their company, it seems to me it's pretty clear who's right in that one.
Let's move on to the matter of what is and what is not anti-Semitic criticism of Israel. Stephen Rohde, what is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance? How does it define the term anti-Semitic criticism of Israel? And what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I'm so glad we're covering this topic in detail. The transition from our previous discussion points out that the one DEI area that Trump is protecting is anti-Semitism, which he then includes Zionism and the criticism of Israel. So of all of attacking racism and sexism and homophobia and Islamophobia, he's carving out a special exception for fighting anti-Semitism, which he defines to include criticism of Israel. So that's really what we're confronting today. And the device they've used, as you explained in the introduction, is this International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition. The IHRA is an intergovernmental organization. It was founded back in 1998 for the legitimate goal of promoting Holocaust education and combating genuine anti-Semitism and the hatred of Jews. And it's got 34 member countries, including Israel and the United States. It's got an acceptable working definition of anti-Semitism that I don't think anybody would have much quarrel with. The problem is that definition doesn't include Zionism or Israel. It's a traditional definition of anti-Semitism. And there are examples that the IHRA definition includes, which also are certainly examples of anti-Semitism, such as making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews, such as the power of Jews, or that the myth that they are a world Jewish conspiracy, or Jews control the media, economy, government, and other societal institutions. A variety of well-worn tropes that are clearly anti-Semitic. Those examples are legitimate. It's the problem is with the rest of the definition.
Give us some examples of the rest of that definition that you contend are not, in fact, examples of true anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and this is the core of why the wholesale adoption of the IHRA definition and examples into federal law is so dangerous. Because when you get to some of the 11 examples, it includes things like, and this is what's supposed to be anti-Semitism, claiming that the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor. That's all about the state of Israel by its own terms. There are some people who deeply believe it is a racist endeavor in terms of how it treats Palestinians and Arab minorities with a two level of citizenship in Israel, and certainly what it's done in Gaza. That's a political statement. You can agree with it. You can disagree with it. It may be offensive or controversial, but that kind of statement about a country is protected by the First Amendment. Other examples show why this is so problematical. There's one that says, applying double standards by requiring of the state of Israel a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. Well, the whole concept is about the state of Israel. That didn't say anything about Judaism or Jews. The state of Israel, by according to the International Court of Justice, They found a plausible case for genocide. Now, genocide is against international law. It's being applied in that example, in that case, against Israel. That's not a double standard. That's applying international law to Israel. And they give other examples, including drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. Many people deeply believe what's been going on in Israel is akin to what the Nazis did to the Jews in Germany and the Holocaust, including since October 7 and the genocide in Gaza. You're entitled to say those words. You cannot be silenced and censored if you choose to compare the country of Israel to the Nazi regime. You can disagree with it, you can debate it, but you can't suppress it by censorship and by the use of this definition. And that's what's so sinister and dangerous about dragging the IHRA definition into federal law. Because it will allow that broad definition and criticism of Israel to be punished civilly or even criminally.
Steve, people argue, of course, that, well, Israel, though, is a Jewish state. So if you criticize Israel, by definition, you're criticizing the Jewish people. But I was, and I think you were, very active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. That movement was harshly critical, sharply critical of the United States government, made up of American people. It wasn't anti-American. It was populated by American people, including members of the military, for goodness sakes. We weren't criticizing the people of America. We were criticizing the government. Same was true with South Africa, with its apartheid government. We weren't speaking against South African people. We were speaking against a government of South Africa, which was discriminating against the black people in the same way that Israel discriminates against the Palestinians. Would you agree that that's a fair disposal of the argument, that because Israel is a largely Jewish nation, that any criticism of Israel by definition becomes anti-Semitic?
That's exactly right. And they cannot clothe themselves. You know, they have adopted Jewish symbols. The Jewish star is on their flag. They've adopted other symbols. But and we'll talk about Zionism a little later, I believe. But this was the risk that Israel took. A lot of people worried about forming a Jewish state and a theocracy. Now they've done that, but that doesn't allow them to be insulated from criticism exactly along the lines you pointed out.
The idea of giving the IHRA definition the force of law has drawn criticism in Europe and the U.S. Tell us about that. Have any European universities adopted the IHRA definitions? And if you don't mind, tell us also about the criticism by Kenneth S. Dern, who helped draft the document.
Yes, I think it's very important that we learn from experience because this definition has been heavily criticized in Europe, where it has been adopted by some jurisdictions. Let's begin with Kenneth Stern, who you brought up. Kenneth Stern was one of the authors of this definition and the examples. He is a scholar of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. But Kenneth Stern believes and has publicly stated that the definition should not be enacted into law. In 2011, he co-authored an article about how the definition was being misused in an attempt to, quote, restrict academic freedom and punish political speech. In December 2016, he wrote a letter to Congress warning that giving the definition legal status would be unconstitutional and unwise. In December 2019, he said the definition was created primarily so that European data collectors could know what to include and exclude, but it was never intended to be a campus hate speech code. Now, that's the man, one of the people who wrote the definition. Why aren't we listening to him in the halls of Congress and our state legislatures and our college campuses? In February 2017, 243 British academics wrote an open letter in which they contended that this definition seeks to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and it raised concerns about muddying the definition of anti-Semitism and restricting free debate on Israel. We've been warned about this time and time again. In August 2018, Professor Rebecca Ruth Gould at the University of Birmingham published the first extended scholarly critique of the IHRA definition and examples. She noted that since its adoption in several European countries, at least five universities, and likely more, have had planned events canceled or otherwise censored due to a perceived need to comply with this definition even before it became law. And in a later opinion piece, Professor Gould pointed to the many ways in which the IHRA definition has been used to censor speech, particularly on university campuses. We should be listening to experts who've studied this in the past. And then in January 2021, listen to this, 66 UK Israeli academics wrote an open letter opposing the IHRA definition because, quote, it inhibits free speech and academic freedom. It deprives Palestinians of their own legitimate voice within the UK public space. And finally, it inhibits us, Israeli nationals, from exercising our democratic right to challenge our own government. Now, here in the United States, unfortunately, the House ignored all of that scholarly and thoughtful criticism, but some legislators resisted that. 70 Democrats voted against the bill in the House, along with 21 Republicans. Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, a Jewish lawmaker who describes himself as a deeply committed Zionist, called the bill misguided because it threatens to chill constitutionally protected speech. That is from a Jewish ally of Israel. He added that speech that's critical of Israel alone does not constitute unlawful discrimination. Then more recently, in May of last year, 1,200 Jewish university professors, and among them were prominent ones your listeners have heard of, Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, journalist and professor Peter Beinart, and Yale Law and History Professor Samuel Moyne, signed a strongly worded statement rejecting the IHRA definition. They urged their political leaders not to codify into federal law a definition of anti-Semitism that conflates anti-Semitism with criticism of the state of Israel. And they went on to extend their remarks and make the point that far from combating anti-Semitism, this dynamic promises to amplify the real threats Jewish Americans already face. This is strong, thoughtful opposition to adopting this definition, yet now Trump has elevated it in his executive order, and he's pushing and trying to make it federal law.
Steve, let's stay with the university situation for a minute and the charges of anti-Semitism. New York University went so far as to make Zionists on their campus a protected class that could not be discriminated against, which is to say could not be spoken against, and therefore demonstrations against Zionist Israel were considered an attack on the Zionist Jewish students on the campus and were prohibited. The Harvard University, as I think you may have already mentioned, has already adopted the IHRA definitions of what constitutes anti-Semitism. Columbia University is in this regard, started disciplining students. They've used those same definitions, as well as H.R. Bill number 320, to attack pro-Palestinian student protests and to discipline students from those protests. So these interpretations, these definitions of so-called anti-Semitism that you pointed out are really not. They're simply definitions, by definition, criticisms of the government of Israel, are being used nevertheless to silence protest and to silence academic freedom. And as we know, college professors have lost their jobs from writing non-anti-Semitic literature and statements about what is going on in Palestine. Talk to us about that.
Yes, this is very dangerous because what's happening is we are expanding now to include the term Zionist as a protected term. Zionism was a 19th century political theory to create a state of Israel. There were a lot of Jews who opposed Zionism. Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, a whole organization of Jewish groups were formed, warning other Jews that if you form a Jewish state, if it becomes a theocracy, if it takes on the panoply of powers, of military force, of exclusion, it can be dangerous and it can backfire on the Jewish people. Sadly, so many of those warnings and predictions have come to pass. So Zionism can be criticized along with any other political theory. So what's happening on college campuses is they are so fearful. College presidents, we can remember their appearance before Congress December a year ago. They are so fearful of being labeled an anti-Semite. I mean, after all, it is one of the most powerful slurs and epithets in world history to be called an anti-Semite. And by stretching that term to include criticism of Israel and just throw around the term anti-Semitism, that has silenced so much of the discussion that should be happening regarding the state of Israel, its government, Bibi Netanyahu, and all the rest. What should have happened in the last 18 months or so, we should have had a national debate. The college presidents should have distinguished virulent anti-Semitism from protected political criticism of Israel. We would have gone through last year with much more clarity over that. And instead, the ADL and other organizations and now Trump and Congress have collapsed all of that so that now all you need to say is there's a rising tide of anti-Semitism. Colleges aren't protecting against anti-Semitism. All thoughtful analysis shuts down. And that is what's so dangerous. This is happening at a time when on our college campuses there have been physical and violent attacks on pro-Palestinian protests and encampments. A college professor at Columbia has been forced out because she went on Amy Goodman's show and raised the fact that Israeli students who come to Columbia are trained in the IDF, as all young people under mandatory requirements are. And she raised the concern that you have military-trained students who then, in specific cases, turned around and assaulted pro-Palestinian demonstrators. So with facing all of that, what do the defenders of Israel and these college campuses do? They implement the epithet of anti-Semitism to silence that kind of discussion and debate. It's corrupting the course of our debates in America, and we should have listened to the experience in Europe, and I tremble to think what is coming up as our college semester goes forward.
Steve, let me follow that up. I'm wondering about this whole matter of anti-Semitism. Goodness knows there's all too much real anti-Semitism in this world and in this country. But I'm wondering, I wrote a piece about this called "But Is It Good News for the Jews?" It's what Israel is doing in Gaza, the genocide that is being committed there as being recognized by so many international bodies, that is wrongfully still so, but creating more anti-Semitism. That it isn't the criticism itself which is anti-Semitic, but what happens is when any nation engages in what Israel is doing in Gaza, just as when the United States engaged in what it was engaged in Vietnam, there then does tend to be a hatred of the American people, a hatred of the Jewish people, which is to be decried. Am I wrong about that?
No, Jim, you're really on to something. This is what I meant when I said that Israel and the founders of Israel took on a tremendous burden when they established a government and a state, a Jewish state, because then any problems that Israel has, or especially any violations of human rights and now genocide, is visited upon all of the Jewish people. We may not desire that. That may itself be faulty logic. But it rests with Netanyahu and his war cabinet to have caused so much devastation, frankly, for the last 75 years on the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank, but certainly since October 7. I don't think there's a rise in classic, virulent anti-Semitism. I think there's a rise in opposition to what the Israeli government is doing and the military operation, which people then allied with Jews because Israel allies itself with Jews. And the complexity of that should not be visited upon critics of Israel. It's a responsibility of Israel for having taken these overt acts in violation of international law. It reminds me the use of anti-Semitism as an epithet throughout history. There have been times when you want to silence other people. You could call them heretics. You could call them blasphemers. In more recent history, we tried to silence left-wing politics in America by calling people communists as an epithet to shut down that entire debate we needed to have in the last century. And now you use the epithet of anti-Semitism to silence that debate. Sadly, on college campuses, we have a two-class society, much as Israel has a two-class society. On college campuses, powerful anti-Palestinian speech is protected, while pro-Palestinian speech is silenced. And it is sadly mirroring what has gone on in Israel itself.
Well, Steve, that leads us to the question, is academic freedom as a whole being placed on the chopping block by the Trump administration and by colleges and universities as well? As you mentioned, colleges are clamping down on anti-Israeli, pro-Palestinian protests on their campuses because they fear the Trump administration will cut their funding. What are your thoughts on this?
It's tragic that our college campuses in this context have gone this way. College campuses were, in the modern era, were conceived of as forums for robust, wide-open debate of any idea imaginable. It was a safe space where students could come, could learn, could read, could debate. No idea was off limits. And we've lost our way in that regard in many respects. And we certainly have lost our way in this recent era of campus protest for what is going on in Gaza and the West Bank. The American Association of University Professors has spoken up on this. Faculties have spoken up because we focused on students a lot today, but faculty members, and an example I already gave, have been the target of the same kind of demonization, labeling and targeting their speech as anti-Semitic, when it's only pure political speech. I don't know if we can come through this period because instead of clarifying all of this, the Trump administration's executive orders has put their thumb on that side of the scale. The Trump administration has ordered new investigations into Columbia, Northwestern, NYU, Berkeley, and other campuses to renew this kind of punishment of those campuses. And I don't put it beyond the Trump administration to literally cut off funding of these campuses. They fear generally that the campuses are a hotbed of resistance to Trump in many respects. Beyond this Israeli-Palestinian debate, many college campuses are rising up to oppose what Trump is doing when it comes to DEI and immigration and borders and women's rights and reproductive rights. They know our college campuses have often been a source of opposition to government abuse. And to defund these college campuses will have a tragic impact on our educational system, which Trump is trying to dismantle in many other respects. We're in for a very difficult period, and we're only going to get through it with clear thinking and with the kind of analysis that I'm grateful we're doing here on Law and Disorder.
All right, Steve, I'm afraid we are out of time, but I understand you've got some breaking news you want to share.
Well, as we're recording this program, it's been announced that Chuck Schumer will co-sponsor the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act in the Senate. This is the bill that would put into law, not just by Trump's fiat, but by Congress, the definition of anti-Semitism that we've been criticizing throughout this program. This means that listeners who are moved by our discussion today need to call their senators. You need to object to the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act as a frontal assault on freedom of speech, protest, and academic freedom. And this is one more time when the people have to exercise their voice and ensure that this very damaging law does not go into effect.
Well, Steve Rohde, thank you on behalf of myself, Jim Lafferty, and Maria Hall. We thank you so much for being our guest today. You've done a wonderful job, just as you do when you're our co-host. And we'll see you back in both capacities, I'm sure.
Thank you both.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by returning guest, author, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges.
We discuss a range of topics, including the impact of America's new oligarchy and fascistic Trump regime.
We talk with a nationally known expert on immigration rights and low-wage workers about Donald Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants back to their home countries.
Attorney Victor Naro joins us. He's project director for the UCLA Labor Center and for the core faculty of the UCLA Department of Labor Studies.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Last month, Elon Musk said something about the Trump election with which we could all agree. He said, "This was no ordinary victory. This was a fork in the road of human civilization," end quote. Now our democracy, however restricted by class and race, is in the process of being replaced by a super wealthy oligarchy. There are over 800 billionaires in the USA. They're now in the saddle. The Citizens United Supreme Court case of 2010 eased the process. Trump was elected with money from 10 people, pretty much. Elon Musk alone contributed $27 million. That is over $250 million from one man to another man. Biden himself, in his farewell address, warned of the takeover by an oligarchy. Echoing President Eisenhower's famous warning of a military-industrial complex, Biden talked about the, quote, tech-industrial complex. The second Trump administration will not be like the first. It won't be incoherent or chaotic. This has been guaranteed by the Heritage Foundation, who wrote a 920-page playbook for dismantling our democracy. The process has begun with Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords and calling for more drilling. Drill, baby, drill is his mantra. This is a race towards human extinction. On January 21st, he pulled out of the World Health Organization. The day he was sworn in, he pardoned some 1,500 people who had participated and even led the January 6th insurrection. This is a green light for fascist mobs who now feel they can get away with anything. The Democratic Party has greased the skids for this transition. It cannot be relied on for the defense of the American people. Biden and Harris, after accurately calling Trump a fascist in the last few weeks of the election period, then did an about-face, welcoming him to the White House, saying they would cooperate with him and praising his peaceful transition, a transition that Trump himself said that if he lost, he would not abide by. Today, we speak with Chris Hedges. His penetrating journalism has resulted in his being fired and deplatformed, starting from the New York Times, where he was the Middle East bureau chief and Pulitzer Prize winner, to the Real News Network, where he was fired because of his criticism of Biden and the Democratic Party. Chris Hedges is the author of many books and writes on Substack. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, in his farewell address 2 weeks ago, Biden warned of the dangers of an oligarchy ruling over us. But America's always had a ruling class. After all, George Washington, the father of our country, was the richest man in America in his time. Is rule by an oligarchy different?
Yes. So I looked at this election as really a contest between corporatists and oligarchs. And corporate capitalism is different from oligarchic capitalism. Corporate capitalism is about stability because it's about investments and often important trade deals. So investments are made in countries like China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Mexico, wherever. Oftentimes it takes a long time, significant amount of time to turn a profit because you're producing. So you want that decorum, you want that stability of an Obama or a Biden or, you know, even a Bush, as limited as Bush was. Oligarchic capital is another animal. Oligarchy wants chaos. It wants, as Steve Bannon says, to destroy the administrative state because it is a pure form of rentier capitalism. What it does, and this is what Amazon does and Google, it sets up toll booths. And you have to go through those toll booths. It extracts revenue in order for people to have access to goods and services. So I wrote a book called America, The Farewell Tour. It opens in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Scranton at the time was facing bankruptcy, and it was selling off or had sold off its sewer system, its parking authority, its electrical system, everything to private equity firms that jacked up the prices and, of course, deteriorated the services. So that's what you're seeing, and this the oligarchs won in this election. And that's why you're seeing a rapid attempt to deconstruct all of the mechanisms in the state, including the Department of Education calls to privatize the Postal Service, because that's how oligarchs make money. So that's what the battle was, and that you were correct in your introduction to point out the power of oligarchs within this new administration.
I wonder, Chris, if you could explain the origins, if you will, of this American oligarchy that Biden spoke of. Where does it come from? How long has it been around? How has it developed? What are its principal origins?
Well, that's one of the ironies, because it's essentially unfettered, unregulated corporate power that created the oligarchic class and triggered this war within capitalism. So, and slashing the tax codes, which was a bipartisan effort. So you had the wealthiest among us, the billionaire class, paid less and less in terms of taxes. They were able to create monopolies like the digital platform monopolies. They were able to amass, individuals were able to amass tremendous amounts of wealth like Musk, like Bezos, and others. And their interest conflicted with the corporatists. So yes, oligarchs have always been with us, but it's been a long time since oligarchs have essentially run the country. They always had outsized influence given their wealth and power. But now we're living under a pure oligarchy. And these people are working very hard to dismantle all of civic society. Everything is to become privatized. And they want instability, because the more instability, the more people have to pay for services, including security. So everything becomes an a form of extraction. Everything becomes predatory.
Chris, please talk about the destruction of our American form of government. Bernie Sanders, in a recent WBAI interview, stated that the billionaires have taken over the media, the political process through huge donations, and the government. Billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, are they utilizing Trump to effect a restructuring of American society?
Yes. I mean, let's not let the Democrats get a pass. The Democrats have been full partners in this deconstruction of American society. Programs of austerity, deindustrialization under NAFTA was carried out by the Clinton administration, ripping down the firewalls between investment and commercial banks with revoking Glass-Steagall was a Clinton project. The destruction of our system of welfare, and 70% of the recipients under the old welfare system were children, was a Democratic project. The militarization of police, the huge expansion of our carceral system, that was all a Democrat. It was a bipartisan, but it was led by the Democrats. So the Democrats are complicit in all of this, but the Democrats remain primarily a creature of corporate America rather than oligarchic America. So the deterioration within the American democracy was certainly carried out by both parties, and that seizure of power by the billionaire class and by corporations, so that you've deformed all institutions, and you mentioned the media correctly. It's a very important point that Ralph Nader makes about how 4 decades ago, the media used to report on the grassroots organizations, unions, civic organizations, many of which Ralph founded and led to carry out environmental reforms and worker safety reforms. And then, because they began to cater increasingly to their advertisers, they erased coverage. And that crippled those movements. And you've seen, especially with the rise of the internet, constriction of media entities like the New York Times. Their coverage on Gaza has been awful. It's been horrendous, including banning reporters from using words like, refugees and this kind of stuff, Palestine itself, in an internal memo that was leaked to The Intercept. So the all of the institutions that once protected and safeguarded democracy have become captive to corporate power, including, of course, universities. So you have these, in a coordinated effort, these universities have shut down free speech and dissent on college campuses from coast to coast to placate their billionaire donors and turn them into academic gulags. And that is, again, another projection of oligarchic and corporate power.
You know, Chris, at the end of the recent election cycle, Kamala Harris and other Democrats, referred to Trump as a fascist. But now they seem to have stopped this. Trump was welcomed into the White House. Biden said in his farewell address, quote, "I wish the incoming administration success," close quote. Does this not scare you? I mean, can we ever and certainly now rely on the Democrats to protect us from the fascistic, authoritarian rule that Trump is already demonstrating?
No, the Democrats, I think, are kind of a dead party, and they fused with the establishment wing of the Republican Party. That's why Harris was touting her endorsement by Dick Cheney, a war criminal who left office with a 13% approval rating. I mean, they're completely tone deaf, completely out of touch. She led a vapid, celebrity-filled, issueless campaign. And the Democrats, in their postmortems, continue to show that they're completely unplugged from the reality of most Americans. It's all about branding, or we should have done this, or Biden should have left earlier, without addressing the most crucial dislocation of the American working class. 30 million Americans in mass layoffs since 1996, which the Democrats were responsible for. So not only have they refusing to address.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm very proud of the job that this group of young people, generally young people, but very smart people, they're doing. They're doing it at my insistence. It would be a lot easier not to do it, but we have to take some of these things apart to find the corruption. We found tremendous corruption.
Legal experts are warning of a constitutional crisis as the Trump administration hints it may ignore a federal judge's ruling, temporarily blocking Elon Musk and his Doge associates from accessing the Treasury Department's payment systems and American sensitive data. Over the weekend, Musk called for the judge to be impeached. Vice President Vance questioned the judge's authority. We'll look at Doge's young so-called engineers who are playing a key role in Musk's overhaul of federal agencies. We'll speak with Wired reporter Victoria Elliott, who's broken major stories on Musk and the young men who comprise his Doge army. Meanwhile, the South African-born billionaire Elon Musk is claiming white South Africans have been victims of racist ownership laws and accused the post-apartheid government of anti-white racism, pushing the Trump administration to cut off all aid Friday until further notice to South Africa. This comes after Musk's father helped arrange a call with the South African president to oppose the land reform law.
I can only imagine that Elon would have said, look, we want to help you, but you have to quit this war on white people in South Africa.
We'll go to South Africa and then to the occupied West Bank as Israel intensifies its military assault, which has displaced 35,000 Palestinians, and Trump doubles down on his plans for Gaza.
I'm committed to buying and owning Gaza.
We'll speak with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti in Ramallah. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's giving hints it may ignore a federal judge's ruling restricting Elon Musk and his associates in Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency, from accessing the Treasury Department's critical payment systems. In his decision, U.S. District Judge Paul Engelmeyer warned about the, quote, disclosure of sensitive and confidential information and the heightened risk that the systems in question will be more vulnerable than before to hacking, unquote. Vice President J.D. Vance responded to the ruling by writing on social media, quote, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power, unquote. Elon Musk also called for the judge to be impeached. On Sunday, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy appeared on ABC This Week and warned against what he called the billionaire takeover of the government.
And I think this is the most serious constitutional crisis the country has faced, certainly since Watergate. The president is attempting to seize control of power and for corrupt purposes. The president wants to be able to decide how and where money is spent so that he can reward his political friends. He can punish his political enemies. That is the evisceration of democracy.
In other news about Doge, Elon Musk says he's rehiring 25-year-old Marco Ellis, who resigned after being linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics, among other things, writing, "Normalize Indian hate." Trump and J.D. Vance had both called for him to be rehired. Donald Trump has repeated his proposal for the United States to take ownership of Gaza, describing Gaza as a, quote, big real estate site. Trump said it would be a, quote, big mistake to let Palestinians